KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to The Menu on Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. After nearly a half century, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians has their full subsistence hunting and fishing rights restored. They were forced to sign them away to get federal recognition. A new children's book portrays Lamprey in the cuddliest way possible. Author Brooke Thompson was inspired to write I Love Salmon and Lamprey after she witnessed a salmon kill in 2022 in the Klamath River. And a new eatery by Indigenous chef and restaurateur Blue Adams reimagines American cuisine. That's all on the menu after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee and other Republicans are pushing back against the Trump administration's DEI purge of Native Americans, quite literally, from federal government websites. Correspondent Nikolai Butler reports from Washington that even members of the president's own party are aghast at efforts to erase First Americans from government websites.
Republicans in Congress are behind most of President Donald Trump's efforts to reshape Washington in his own image. But even his GOP allies say Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, team crossed the line by literally erasing the term Native American from some government sites.
I don't know why you just do that as a matter of course.
I hadn't seen that.
No.
I have no idea.
Wait, I don't understand the question.
That's Republican U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, James Langford of Oklahoma, and Kevin Cramer of North Dakota. They're angry web pages honoring Navajo code talkers were deleted at the Pentagon. The administration restored the pages, calling it a mistake, but the mistakes don't stop there.
It's Native American, it's Native American.
Senator Cramer of North Dakota's no fan of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, but he says the administration went too far.
I don't know. I mean, it seems weird. I don't know why you do that. But first thing I do is check with local Native people to see what their preference is, because some of them don't like it.
Senate Indian Affairs Committee Chair Lisa Murkowski has been leaning on Interior Department and Health and Human Services officials to ensure tribal programs aren't caught up in this DEI purge.
That was why it was important to get some assurance, some confirmation that when it came to tribes and tribal programs, they were not going to be subject to this DEI initiative. We got that assurance through Interior. We got it through HHS.
But Murkowski says other federal agencies have some catching up to do.
We're seeing this in other accounts, which is troubling. We've reached out to address this because it's not the way it should be.
It's not the way it should be.
Alaska's other senator, Dan Sullivan, calls the erasure of tribal references a huge misstep. The Republicans suggest Musk and his DOGE team are in need of a history lesson.
Tribes and Native Americans are in the Constitution. Maybe some people should go reread their Constitution.
For National Native News, Nikolai Butler in Washington.
The search for a missing Grand Ronde tribal elder continued over the weekend. 63-year-old Jonathan House disappeared in mid-March after leaving a crashed truck in the Coast Range foothills west of Junction City. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, prospects are dim that House is still alive.
House was said to be upset when he drove off from home, and flyers say he sounded distressed in his last call to his partner on March 15th. This weekend, teams of the Lane County Sheriff's Office and the MMIW Search and Hope Alliance searched around Dancing Deer Mountain. Bill Bernard covered almost 800 acres with his drone.
The sheriff's office was kind enough to share coordinates of the last cell phone ping. Unfortunately, that indicated that he didn't progress towards town or towards a road. It actually indicated that he headed deeper into the forest.
We're not going to stop looking for him. He's out there somewhere.
Kim Linning organized the volunteer search. Given the time and elements, she knows it's looking dire for House.
We're looking for his body, his remains. The family is very understanding and thankful and really great.
Anyone with information on House is asked to call the Lane County Sheriff's Office. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is The Menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food sovereignty. I'm Andy Murphy. From the age of 7, Brooke Thompson has had a special connection to salmon and the Klamath River. Her 7-year-old self would have loved her new children's book called I Love Salmon and Lampreys. It tells the story of Yurok and Karuk connections to salmon and Klamath River undamming. The Continental is a new restaurant in Provo, Utah by restaurateur Blue Adams. It showcases an Indigenous take on American cuisine and is one of many ways Adams has dedicated her entrepreneurial talents to uplifting first foods and chefs. But first, after 45 years, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians just regained their traditional hunting and fishing rights. A consent decree in 1980 traded those rights for the tribe's federal recognition. Now, the elected officials charged with enforcing the consent decree admit it was, in their words, a biased and distorted position on tribal sovereignty. You can join our conversation with your comments and questions today. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Siletz, Oregon is Robert Kenta. He's a member of the Siletz Tribal Council. Welcome to The Menu, Robert.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining. So the tribe has a new development when it comes to hunting and fishing. Can you give us a brief description of the tribal member, or of what the tribal members are now allowed to do?
Yeah. So in the press, it's been described as a regaining of treaty rights, but there really hasn't been an adjudication of our ratified treaty rights yet. And never had been during all of our history from the 1850s when the Siletz Reservation was created and quickly dismantled piece by piece. And then in the 1950s, Congress targeted us with the Termination Act. And so in none of that time were there court proceedings that defined our ratified treaty rights. And so when we reorganized in the 1970s, there were hunting and fishing advocacy groups and the state of Oregon itself that became concerned that we had undefined rights and wanted to lock us into a court order agreement. And so we got through restoration itself in 1977. We were the second tribe in the nation who had been terminated to regain federal recognition, but we were the first landless tribe. And so ours was different than Menominee, who was ahead of us. They had been turned into a corporate structure and not been forced to give up their reservation land. And so when we came along, we had been totally liquidated of what little reservation remained in the 1950s. And so the state really had veto power over our ability to regain an initial reservation. Our congressman at the time, Les Aucoin, said he wouldn't introduce or support any legislation returning land to us unless we reached an agreement with the state. So we stepped into federal court with the federal agency, state, and the tribe, and a federal judge signed the order that locked in a very restrictive agreement. And we just finally got the last piece of that within the last month removed from the state law books.
Okay. What were some of the reasons why folks were concerned about unrestricted hunting and fishing for the tribes back then?
Yeah, well, our reservation started out at 1.1 million acres and included a third of the Oregon coast, and so a third basically or more of the Oregon coastal rivers. And as those areas of reservation were opened up to non-Indian settlement, big communities of non-tribal peoples moved in and began their sport fisheries. And there were commercial salmon canneries at the mouth of every river within what had been reservation. So there were a lot of people with skin in the game when it came to our what should have been our exclusive use hunting and fishing resources, and that had big political power within the state. So the state itself was nervous about having to deal with another tribe that had extensive rights, because the Bolt and Baloney decisions in U.S. v. Oregon and U.S. v. Washington, where the state or the federal government came in and actually sued the states for not upholding recognition of tribal treaty rights. So we were kind of, our restoration and initial reservation legislation was in the shadows of all of that other litigation that was going on over primarily fishing rights in the Northwest.
All right, so it's taken decades to get to this point. And you mentioned just this month that the final, I guess, piece of paper was signed. Take us through, like, what the process was for getting to this point and what that last step was this month.
Yeah, well, really hats off to our former governor, Kate Brown. She met with us, told us that she understood that history of the consent decree, how unfair it was. She said it was unconscionable that us and the Grand Round Tribe were both forced into signing consent decrees in federal court. So that she directed the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to work in good faith with us on a new agreement. And we got that agreement in place, but the consent decree was still a federal court order that could be referred back to if the state became unhappy or a new administration came in and said, oh, we're not doing that. So we had to get congressional legislation to remove the reference to the consent decree from our 1980 Reservation Act. And then as the tribe, the state, and those federal agencies who had signed on to the consent decree had to step back into federal court and get a federal judge to vacate the consent decree itself. And then this last step that just happened within the last month was the Fish and Wildlife Commission for the state of Oregon had to remove the regulation from the books that implemented the 1980 consent decree. So we're happy that all of those things, it took a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of educating, but we're there. So we're back to the situation legally, basically, as we were at termination and restoration time.
Okay. So this is a federal decision, right? And what role did the state play?
Well, the state was the one who insisted, and our congressional delegation from Oregon went along with it. So it involved both federal legislation by the reference being to the consent decree being included in our 1980 federal legislation that recreated the Siletz Reservation, or the initial restored reservation. Okay. And then the state had its regulation that it implemented, and it was so restrictive that our attorneys could be hauled into the Oregon bar and their license for practicing law could be challenged. They could be threatened with disbarment if they even raised the issue of rights outside of that consent decree.
And what were some of those restrictions on tribal hunters and fishers and gatherers?
Yeah, well, it was very restrictive. 25 elk tags were issued to the tribe from the state, and those were distributed through a lottery system. People had to sign up for the drawing. 375 deer tags, and let's see, what was it? 200, I think, salmon tags that would be a basically like a plastic clip that you would put through the gills of a single fish, but they wouldn't even concede any fishing on the Siletz Main Stem River, only a small tributary designated site for netting, gaffing, or spearing a fish.
Okay. And so now the tribe is taking over issuing those tags and licenses, is that right?
Yeah, so under the new agreement, the state does recognize our sovereign right to issue our own licenses and tags. We always did issue our own licenses, but we were dependent on the state issuing those actual tags for the individual hunters. And so we're back to exercising our sovereign right to issue our licenses and tags, and really don't have those restrictive limits under the 1980 agreement that really bound us.
Okay. All right, we're going to go to a break in just a little bit, but I wanted to ask about the economic side of all of this. Is there an economic benefit now for the tribe?
It really goes back to our cultural right to feed ourselves from the land that has always taken care of us, that we take care of in exchange. And so there is some reduction of grocery bills for tribal families, but also a return of our values of feeding ourselves from the land and water.
All right. All right, we'll be back after this break. This is The Menu on Native America Calling. You can join us at 1-800-996-2848. Punk music is the anthem of resistance and resilience, and Native punk bands like Blackfire, 1876, and Dead Pioneers are among the indigenous voices for these tumultuous times. A new project is archiving indigenous punk for future generations. We'll explore the enduring importance of punk music on the next Native America Calling.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
The
You are tuned in to The Menu on Native America Calling, our regular feature on Indigenous food. I'm Andy Murphy, and we're talking with Siletz Tribal Councilman Robert Kenta about his tribe getting their hunting and fishing rights back. After that, we'll talk with Brooke Thompson about her new children's book called I Love Salmon and Lampreys. Later, we'll talk with Blue Adams about her new restaurant, The Continental. You can join our conversation, too, by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Going back to Robert over there in Siletz, Oregon. Robert, I want to ask you, now that fishing and hunting rights have been reinstated, how different do you think tribal gatherings and just the cultural part of the tribe will be now that you guys have these rights back?
Yeah, we were in a pretty oppressive situation, and I'm glad that the state recognized that and kind of reversed position. We're in a whole new reset time of relationship with the state on hunting, fishing, and gathering rights. But it's amazing to see the excitement, not only in our older folks who have had to live under those restrictions for so long, but young people, and it won't be long before there'll be a new generation who won't have kind of experienced growing up under those restrictions. So it's a big cultural revitalization, and people are feeling much more free to engage in hunting, fishing, and gathering. We had some tribal members that were ticketed for clamming, and that's what really started to kick this conversation off. And the state finally realized and reversed their position on those kinds of regulations.
Okay. So you mentioned clam so far, salmon, elk, deer. Are there any other wildlife or fish that we could start seeing more of on Siletz dinner tables?
Yeah, all of the fish and game, shellfish species are included in our new agreement with the state. And we're more or less following kind of the state limits, but we can extend permitting to allow people to gather for elders and family and friends who don't have a hunter, fisher, or gatherer in their family. And so we're able to gather beyond the state individual permit limits and distribute those to families that need that help.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Robert, for joining us and sharing this news with us about fishing and hunting rights there in Siletz, Oregon. I want to go over to our guest now in Eureka, California. We have Brooke Thompson. She is an author, civil engineer, activist, artist, and a full-time PhD student of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's Yurok and Karuk. Welcome to the menu, Brooke.
Thank you for having me. Ayakwi.
So a lot of your career and interests revolve around the environment. How do salmon and lampreys, which is the subject of your book, tell the story you want to tell?
So for me, the story of salmon and lamprey is a story of us as Indigenous people along the northern part of California, because right, our health and our lives are so interconnected with the Klamath River, where the tribe lives along, my tribes being Yurok and Karuk, that really the river's health impacts the salmon and lamprey's health, which impacts our health as people, in addition to all the other plants and life around the river, such as the eagles, the condors, the birds, the basket gathering material, etc., is all connected to the river and thus salmon and lamprey. So my book tells a story of that experience growing up on the Klamath River and why I think more people should love salmon and lamprey, and especially lamprey, because they tend to be a little bit harder to love.
Yeah, you worked with illustrator who made the lampreys pretty cuddly and approachable. What was it like working with the illustrator, especially when it came to illustrating lampreys, or, you know, some of the harvested or dead salmon that are in the book?
Yeah, so I found out kind of in hindsight that I went about this book in an interesting way. Mm-hmm. Usually publishers find the illustrator for you. I actually found this illustrator just through searching online and seeing someone who might need some extra income. And my illustrator is from the Ukraine. And so there's the war going on in the Ukraine right now. And also her images are just so great. And she's a watercolor artist. And since this book's about water partially too, I thought that would be an appropriate art form. So we kind of went back and forth. I would draw a layout and then she would give me a draft, and then I'd go back, make edits, give her reference photos, and then she'd do a painting. And it was kind of more of a collaborative back and forth piece of work than it was just me giving her the text and her coming up with the images, especially since a lot of the images are of my local area, which are so specific and very different than I assume what the Ukraine looks like. I've never been there myself.
Okay, and you, in the book, you also talk about witnessing a fish kill. Talk about that and how that really, you know, inspired you to go into environmental work.
Yeah, so part of the book is about my own life, because that's the story I know best, and it's about when I was 7 years old and I saw the 2002 fish kill in the Klamath River, which was the largest fish kill in West Coast history. And nothing in our oral history of being on the river since time immemorial has ever shown anything remotely like that fish kill happening, where close to 60,000 salmon died that day in September of 2002. And so as a 7-year-old girl at the time who's loved fishing for salmon and lamprey, and that was a big source of our income, our food, and family time, seeing all those dead salmon laying on the shoreline, whose bodies were the size of my own being a little girl, was really devastating, not to me, but the entire community. And it has continued to carry on this type of generational trauma, a fear of this happening again. And thus why we pushed for the dam removal. And I have all these groups come together through this last 24 years to remove the 4 dams on the Klamath River, which has ended up being the largest dam removal in US history and possibly world history. So for me, it's a story about the importance of salmon and lamprey, not only from a food aspect, but from a cultural aspect, from a family aspect, from a responsibility aspect as a future ancestor. In addition to the story of success and resiliency on how this horrible thing happened to my people, and that despite all odds and despite what a lot of the adults were being told in the moment, that it's become a reality that I've seen with my own eyes, with the dams now being removed on the Klamath River. And one of the large reasons that inspired me to go into engineering to learn more about infrastructure like dams. And that's kind of what the book's about too. It's also about my story going into academics and why it's important to go to college, and that you can go to college and go to the scary unknown sometimes and then come back to help your community. Kind of how like the salmon live in the river and lamprey live in the river, go out to the ocean when they become adults, but then come back to raise their kids later in their lives.
Great. I want to actually go to a caller we have on the line. We have Donna in Alaska listening on KNBA. Go ahead, Donna.
Keisha, Olamoa, good morning from good morning. Alaska, land of the grizzly bears. I am a member of the Klamath tribe from Oregon, even though I live in Alaska. I keep in contact with what is going on with my tribe through Facebook and, of course, my relatives and family. And I was so excited to hear about those dams being removed from the Klamath River and seeing on Facebook pictures from one of the tribal members, Taylor Tupper, of one of the Tupper girls, of the salmon actually, you know, coming up the river. And it was like, wow, I'm so happy that I lived to see this moment. I'm 74, so I just see the young people doing amazing things, you know, and I'm really proud of all the young Native people because they're out there and they are doing things that us, we didn't have the opportunity to do, you know, because we're getting more educated people and more savvy people as to political things that are going on, but also they've learned, you know, to be diplomatic and nice to people because you can catch more bees with honey, more honey than, you know, vinegar. So be nice to people, talk nice, and we'll have more great results.
All right. Thank you so much, Donna, for chiming into the conversation. Listeners, if you'd like to also chime in, we're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Brooke, Donna mentioned, you know, seeing pictures and videos of water going through these areas after the dams came down. What was it like for you to witness that?
My gosh. I mean, I've seen so many tears of frustration over the last 24 years of fighting for this dam removal. And right, I've had just a very, very small part in this, and my part's mainly been trying to communicate about it to outside the reservation. But I have seen so many of these tears of frustration over these years, and to see the dams come out and then to see, instead of tears of frustration, these tears of relief and happiness and just this idea that the future can be better and that we can make a difference happening has been such a relief. And to see these moments, such as when salmon returned above the dam site for the first time in 100 years, like, you get this feeling, I got this feeling that, you know, it's been worth it. Like, all the frustration, all these late nights staying up worrying, all this time has been put to good use. And I think the caller also mentioned a good point with, you know, living to see this happen, because there's a lot of people out there, there's a lot of people who worked really, really hard on this dam removal who did not get to see it happen firsthand. And so for me, being able to see it in my lifetime, and then also being able to enjoy this moment and celebrate it, not only for myself, but for all those people who should be here celebrating with me, who fought for it and never got to see it happen, I'm also, you know, cry tears of joy for that, and knowing that even though maybe we won't always see the outcomes of our efforts and the energy we put into making the world a better place, to know that sometimes it will make the difference in the long run, despite us seeing those repercussions of it or not.
Right. And telling this story in a children's book, why did you want to do it that way?
That is a great question. So I actually am a international public speaker. I speak to, like, the United Nations at the climate gatherings. I speak to government agencies, to a lot of scientists and professional conferences. And for me, I think it's a responsibility as us as scientists and academics to teach what we're learning, one, to the general public, but two, to kids. I mean, for me, this isn't just a kid's book. This is an everyone book. It's just a simple introduction to the topic. And I often have teachers and parents read the book, tell me that they learned something new that day, or they look something up after reading the book. So I think it's our responsibility to let kids know what's happening and how science relates to their own lives, in addition to also wanting to kind of have this inspirational story for them, because there's so much climate anxiety out there, and especially for the younger generation, even, I mean, already for me, but I can't imagine even younger. And I also want to be able to tell the story of this accomplishment to my tribe, to my younger cousins who now have the privilege to grow up with not having the dams there. And I want them to be able to be told the story of this accomplishment from the tribes, from the local community, and coming together in a way that is fun and easy to understand, in addition to what we talked about before. You mentioned drawing salmon or lamprey specifically in a cuddly way. I actually made lamprey and salmon stuffed animals that I sell, and it was my big goal with that to make literally lamprey be huggable and cute. And so this is kind of an extension of that, making sure, like, oh, just because these things look kind of scary doesn't mean that they don't deserve your love and that they aren't also just as important for our community as the salmon are, even though the salmon are, like, tend to be the more charismatic ones that get more attention. I love teaching kids that, like, for example, lamprey are older than dinosaurs are and even older than sharks. And you just see, like, rooms light up with these kids that get excited about that. And so I also wanted to write this because, you know, I get to then see these kids get so excited about learning about a new animal that they probably haven't been talked about before because it's not very popular outside of the tribes.
Right, right. And talk a little bit more about the response from children. You've gone on a couple of book tours. You've read this book in front of classes. What's been, I guess, the most amazing response from children?
Oh, my gosh. I love that question so much. So the most amazing response has just been the number of hands that go up after I'm done talking and the amount of questions they want to ask during the presentation. So I have just been so thrilled to have these kids, one, be engaged at the ages between like first and fourth grade, but two, just see them wanting to learn more and have questions about even how we have gone to organize. Like, I had a classroom that was told that after one of my presentations, the students wanted to have a discussion on what they could change in their own lives and what they could protect and how they could do that as, you know, like 6-7-year-olds. And that was so exciting for me to know that, you know, they read this book about me being their same age around 7, going and, you know, just kind of following my older cousins and the people at the time and just trying to be supportive in any way I could as a kid because I knew what happened was wrong. And growing up to, you know, have my job be around this now, but and to see them be inspired by that to some level where they at least want to have the conversation or know that they can start to contribute to make that difference even as kids. And for me, part of this too is that we should be pulling kids into the conversation. It's their future. Right. I think kids have great ideas and they're not deterred from, you know, all of the frustrations that maybe we face as adults growing up.
Right. All right, we'll be back after this break.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
April is National Donate Life Month, a time to honor those who gave life to others as an organ or tissue donor. While there are more than 100,000 people across the U.S. waiting for an organ transplant, you can offer hope by registering as an organ donor. Learn more about organ donation with Life Center Northwest, the nonprofit that stewards the gift of life for all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
This is the menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food. I'm Andy Murphy. We're going to be talking with chef and restaurateur Blue Adams about her new restaurant, The Continental, in just a bit. But I want to go back to Brooke Thompson, who is the author of a new children's book called I Love Salmon and Lamprey. You can join our conversation, too. You still got time. We are at 1-800-996-2848. What new Native food businesses or programs have got your attention lately? We're also at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Brooke, in your book, you use a specific kind of font. Tell me more about why you chose the particular font for your book.
Yes, so the font in my book is called Open Dyslexic, and it's made specifically for kids with dyslexia, or adults in my case, to be easier to read. And that's because of how the words are weighted, which makes it harder to turn around or flip in someone who has dyslexia's mind. And I myself have severe dyslexia. I struggled with reading and writing my entire life, which is kind of my own accomplishment to write a book, even if it's just a children's book. And I just had such a hard time reading growing up that it stopped me from enjoying as many stories as I would have liked to. So if this is the one thing I can do to make it a little bit easier for other kids with dyslexia or reading disabilities out there to enjoy my work, I think it was just a very easy switch to make with the font. So yeah.
All right. Brooke, where can we learn more about your work and about your book, I Love Salmon and Lampreys?
So my book is purchasable online, or look at your local bookstore, ask them to order it. You can purchase it from the Heyday website, and you can find me personally at brookmthompson.com. That's BROOKMTHOMPSON, on Instagram at Brooke_M_Thompson. And I'm on all the social medias like Blue Sky, TikTok, all those fun things. And yeah, please reach out and say hi.
All right. I definitely want to have one of those salmon or lamprey stuffed animals that you make. Those look really cool.
Thank you. They are very cuddly, too. Mm-hmm. More so than the real thing.
All right. Thank you so much, Brooke. I want to go over to Blue Adams, who is joining us from Provo, Utah. She's the executive chef of The Continental. She's Dene, Mandan, and Hidatsa. Welcome back to the menu, Blue.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So you mentioned to me earlier that this was probably one of the toughest projects you've gotten yourself into, The Continental. Why is that?
So the space is actually pretty large. I knew when I took this project on, we would have to split it into three concepts within a concept. So I think naming it The Continental is appropriate because it kind of encompasses a very large project where we are trying to build a concept that reflects not just my culture, but Indigenous cultures across the continent. So Mesoamerican and Turtle Island and all everything in between. So it's a very large project.
All right. What was this space before?
So before, it's actually a third-generation restaurant space. The two restaurants before struggled, again, with the size of the space. And even the kitchen is bigger than any kitchen I've ever worked in or had ownership over. So it's just been a struggle. And we're on the east side of the major street in downtown Provo where people don't necessarily cross the street to come over here. So we'd have to build a destination restaurant, which is also proving a little bit difficult, figuring out our best marketing channels, how we can market to people that are interested in a higher priced dining concept. It's just been difficult all around, but we are finding a little bit of success right now. We're at, with the Continental concept, we're at month 4. So we're starting to see our marketing payoff.
All right. And it's a really beautiful place. It's kind of got that like Art Deco sort of vibe to it. Is that something that you wanted personally?
Yes. When I took over the space, it had a French farmhouse feel. Black and white tile, black and white dining chairs, white tablecloth. But the canvas was pretty much blank when we moved in, and the exterior of the building looks kind of like a 1920s, like Batman Gotham. So it just, it came kind of naturally to go with an Art Deco filling. But I also wanted to build the filling of luxury for a couple of reasons. I really wanted an elevated dining experience for the type of cuisine we were going to present, where before my restaurants and my concepts had been kind of rustic and playful and kind of punk rock. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to elevate the experience, because we were going to bring in these beautiful local proteins, local mushrooms, local trout. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to serve them in just a beautiful space.
Yeah, I love the pictures already, and want to definitely visit sometime in the future, take a road trip with my sister or something.
I'd love to feed you.
Yeah. So you mentioned salmon or trout, local produce and local proteins. What are some of the things that, what are some of the menu items that folks can see there right now?
Well, right now, what we're most proud of is our relationship with the Ute tribe, who are restoring their buffalo herds. Traditionally, the buffalo had migrated through the plains areas of Utah, Colorado, down to northern Mexico, all the way from Canada. But those herds and those populations had been reduced, so it was really important for the Ute tribe to bring those herds back, not just for the cultural impact, but for the health of their community, so they could harvest and feed their community better protein sources, better food. We were lucky enough to partner with them, and one of our most popular items was the bison ribeye that we have on the menu. But once we ran through what they were able to provide us with, we pivoted, and now we serve a bison meatball from the ground bison. And we're so happy to be able to purchase in large quantities, because that gives them some revenue then to reinvest back into their program and help maintain their herd. Beyond the bison, we work with Spring Lake Trout, which is a trout farm that is fed by a natural spring just about 20 miles south of us. Sometimes our chefs will go out and either fish or help pick the trout, or the fishmonger will bring them to our restaurant, but they bring them live and our chefs harvest, which is also another important concept for us. So our chefs know we are taking a life, and we need to respect it and honor it, and educate the community on this reciprocal relationship we have with our food system.
Right. Want to ask about your previous restaurant. Like you mentioned, are not as luxurious as this one here. Black Sheep Cafe, I think, only did breakfast and lunch. And this is a whole different animal here you have. What guided your decisions to doing like a dinner restaurant? I mean, how hungry is Utah for indigenous food and food from the continental?
When I sold Black Sheep in 2018, I believe, and then I sold Skoda and Coffee, House of Fry Bread, I went on a pretty lengthy journey doing more advocacy for indigenous food systems, not just at the local, the state, federal, but at the global level, where I was able to travel to Kuwait and represent indigenous foods in those spaces. But having done so for many years, I wanted to move more. Utah is where I was actually born. I was born in Provo, so this is where my belly button is buried, and you know, that's like a tether. It just keeps pulling me back.
Yeah.
Even though I had grown up in my mother's community on the Navajo Reservation and my father's community, the Fort Berthold Reservation, I just keep ending up back here. But also, having grown up in the Southwest, and Utah is a part of that Southwest, I never really saw the representation of our indigenous foods in a lot of the restaurants I had been visiting. So I really wanted to create a home where not only could I help educate people on the loss of farmland in Utah — I think it's estimated we've lost around 100,000 acres in the last 10 years, where I had been born here and lived on and off my whole life, it had been a food basket. Now it's becoming very quickly a food desert. So it was an important thing for me to try to educate and support the tribes here, the five tribes here, and also the 22 tribes of Arizona and 22 tribes of New Mexico, to give them a voice, to give them a place, and to bring chefs and educate them as well on some of the struggles our farmers and food producers have, so they can take that knowledge and they can amplify our voice wherever they travel to. So on that note, we've been able to have guest chefs here. Michael DeLeon, who was here, she had opened Bruto in Denver. He's a indigenous and Mexican chef from Denver area, and his collaboration here at the Continental, you know, he gifted us a bread recipe, actually his meatball recipe. And we're very grateful for that collaboration, because now he can go wherever he's at. I think he's in Napa Valley right now on another cooking residency, and he can share our stories.
You mentioned, you know, selling these restaurants a couple years ago and then going on this big, you know, advocacy sort of trip for the last couple years. What sort of pushed you now to the back of the house?
I missed it.
Yeah.
I was traveling so often, and it was just, it took a little bit of toll, but honestly, now it's half and half. I'm here doing something I love, rekindling my relationship with the restaurant and the restaurant industry and hospitality and food systems, but also half the time I'm still advocating. I'll be in next weekend, I'll be in North Carolina, Asheville, with the James Beard Foundation with their Chef Summit. I believe there's more than 300 chefs that will be attending, and we'll be talking about what we as chefs can do to help uplift other chefs, food producers, farmers, etc., and talk about the struggles that we're having with sourcing food, sourcing healthy food, which we as Indigenous people have always understood. So I want to be that voice, and I want to carry that message from my community to these spaces. And again, just having other chefs amplify our voices and remember that we're a part of this. We're a part of this this profession and this industry, and you know, we need help with that advocacy piece.
Right. So your brother was, you know, your business partner for, you know, a long time. And how did his passing change your plans or maybe inspire you to do something like the Continental?
Well, I'll tell you, I never would have become a chef.
Mm-hmm.
But when we started IndigiHub, which is an organization and a nonprofit organization that helps provide infrastructure and training for chefs, food producers, et cetera, we had built Blackbird Kitchen on the Navajo Reservation, which was a shared teaching kitchen. And that's when he started to train me as a chef. Unfortunately, when COVID hit, it took him pretty quickly. We were just a few months before Navajo Nation got the vaccines, and he contracted COVID, and within a week, he was gone. And that was so difficult, not just for me, but my family and the community. It pushed me to continue that work. So I literally stepped into his chef's shoes, and in his honor, am continuing the work.
Yeah. I saw that following you the last couple years. Saw you pick up that side of you know, the restaurant industry, and really admire your work. I just want to say thank you so much to all of our guests. We just heard from Blue Adams. We had Brooke Thompson on and Robert Kenta. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about Indigenous punk music with the woman who created the Indigenous Punk Archive.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.